On this tape, we are going to investigate Russian music in the 20th century. There are several famous Russian composers, all of whom are very different from each other in the way they approached music. And yet, even though they are very different, they all had to deal with a common problem. And what was the problem? It was the upheaval and government of their native country. To understand Russian 20th century composers, we must understand the environment in which they lived and worked. So before you study the Russian composers on the other tapes published by Music Wonderful Music, let's take a short course in Russian musical history. Before World War I, which took place around the years 1918, Russia was ruled by the Tsars. A Tsar is like a dictator king. Some of the Tsars were good to the people of the country. Many were not. They were not the kind rulers who always did what was best for the people they ruled. Mostly, they did what was best for them. The Tsars, their relatives, and their officers lived in wealth and luxury with beautiful clothes, houses, carriages, and other things, while most of the people were very poor. The last Tsar, whose name was Nicholas, really tried to make some reforms to help his people, but by then, the people were ready for a change. A man named Lenin and his followers helped to depose the Tsar. They set up a new form of government and called themselves communists. The revolution of the Russian people had been a struggle by the people against the Tsars for more than 100 years. Lenin was the man who led the successful revolt against the Tsars. Unfortunately for the Russian people, the cure was worse than the affliction. 4 years later, after Lenin came into power, he died. In 1924, a very cruel, ruthless leader named Joseph Stalin came into power and led the Russian people, now called the Soviet Union, to greater poverty while building a huge industrial military complex to assist in taking over the world. Joseph Stalin's real name was not Joseph Stalin. It was Yosef Vissarionovich Djugashvili. As a political leader, he needed a name that would be easy to say and say something easy to understand. Stalin comes from the Russian word steel. He wanted to be known as the Man of Steel. In America, Superman is known as the Man of Steel. Stalin couldn't fly, but he did want to be known as Superman. One of the first things he did was to elevate the memory of Lenin to that of almost being a god. That worked so well, he did the same thing for himself the following year. He even had the Russian Orthodox Church call him Holy Father. One of the next things he did was to collectivize the farmers. In other words, he collected all of their property. Most of the people in Russia were peasants or farmers at this time. And then he told them how, when, and where to work. And as if this was not bad enough, after the peasants grew their crops for Stalin, Stalin, our Man of Steel, sold the crops to other countries to have money for his own military projects while the peasants starved. These policies did not exactly win friends and influence people, but no problem was too large for the Man of Steel. If the peasants didn't like his policies, he would just murder them. And murder he did. This man made Hitler look tame by comparison, as he killed more than 10 million peasants who didn't like their new leader. 10 million is a lot of people, but nothing in comparison with the other murders he accomplished. Anyone that seemed to threaten his personal power as leader of the Communist Party, he would have assassinated, sent to Siberia, or killed. When his policies to reform Russia and bring wealth to its people didn't work, Stalin would not take the blame. Instead, he would find some poor soul that was just doing what Stalin told him to do and have this person publicly confess and take responsibility for everything that went wrong. That is as if you were playing baseball and accidentally hit the ball through your neighbor's living room window. You quickly grab your little brother from the front of the TV and say, "Listen, I'm going to take you over to Mr. Windbag's house, and I want you to tell him that you broke his window." Your little brother says,
"Why should I tell him I broke it when you're the one who broke it?"
You then proceed to explain that it is because if he doesn't confess, you will kill his mother and father, grandfather and grandmother, dog, cat, and pet canary, and personally bash his face in. This sounds bad, doesn't it? But that's what happened. And of course, your little brother would say, "Anything you say, big brother." Can you imagine what it was like to live in Russia during this time? I am not exaggerating the point. The stress must have been incredible. To get rid of those that complained against his policies, and there were plenty that complained, Stalin murdered not 10 million, but tens of millions. It is hard to comprehend how many millions of his own people he wiped out, just because they disagreed with him. Let me give you an example. If Stalin killed as many people in the United States as he murdered in the Soviet Union, you would have to completely remove all the people in Connecticut, Iowa, Oregon, Alaska, Vermont, District of Columbia, Delaware, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Rhode Island, Idaho, Nevada, New Hampshire, Hawaii, Maine, New Mexico, Nebraska, Utah, West Virginia, Arkansas, Kansas, and Mississippi. That's 23 states. When we think of the violence that might be found in a film like The Terminator or Rambo or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, we are led to exclaim that history is worse than fiction. Stalin's wife tried to get him to ease up on the people. He would not. She committed suicide. In 1953, things were not going well for Stalin. His close advisors by now knew the pattern. If things did not go well for the boss, then they were the ones that got blamed, tried, convicted, and murdered. Stalin was a very healthy, strong man, but somehow, some way in 1953, Stalin mysteriously died, suddenly, on March 5th. And it is a good thing, for by the time Stalin died in 1953, he had nearly murdered an entire generation of Russia's men. If he had reigned another 20 years, who would have been left to tell the tale? What does all of this have to do with music? It has a lot to do with music. The terrifying reign of Joseph Stalin and his successors left no corner of Russian life untouched. After listening to a short piece by the Russian composer Shostakovich entitled Fantastic Dance, we will discuss the rise and fall of music in the land of Russia. Okay, put on your thinking caps. Not everything we do in life is interesting, right? How many of us get our thrills by taking out the garbage, washing the dishes, or reading the phone book? And yet, someone has to do it. For the next couple of minutes, we're going to go through some important details to our story, but perhaps not the most interesting part of our story. Russia did not enter the musical scene until the last half of the 1800s. Before then, the Russian aristocracy would import their music and musicians from Europe. In the last half of the 1800s, several Russian composers rose to prominence that are still remembered today. As I list them, count on your fingers and see how many you have heard of before. One was Peter Tchaikovsky, who wrote the famous Nutcracker Ballet, March Slav, Sleeping Beauty, and 1812 Overture. Anton Rubinstein is another. Rubinstein was a brilliant pianist, rivaling the reputation of Franz Liszt. Rubinstein wanted to be a great composer as well, but he never made it. Then there were five others who were called the Russian Five. These men did not want to just mimic the European tradition, like Tchaikovsky did. They wanted to lift Russian folk music to great art, much like Bartok would do with Hungarian music. The names of the five are Balakirev, Mazursky, Borodin, Kui, and Rimsky-Korsakov. There was also a pianist and composer who continued the piano style of Liszt and Chopin. His name was Scriabin. Scriabin had an interesting philosophy derived from the philosopher Nietzsche. His personal belief was, "I am God, I am the world, I am the center of the universe." Some writers say that his piano works were characterized by a nervous excitement. Trying to be God would make me a little nervous, too. Some people believe he bordered on being insane, but his music, particularly the strange chords, Scriabin called them mystic chords, influenced future Russian composers. One of those future Russian composers was Serge Prokofiev, who wrote Peter and the Wolf. Let's listen to a brief excerpt from his piano concerto, his first piano concerto, that he wrote as a teenager, to kind of give you an idea of the kind of music that the Russians were writing around this time. At the beginning of the century, Russia had produced a new generation of significant composers. Igor Stravinsky, Serge Prokofiev, who you're listening to now, Serge Rachmaninoff, Dmitri Shostakovich, their ideas and compositional skill were taking the musical world by storm. They were the leading composers of the 20th century. A host of other minor composers were also producing some very good musical works. Dmitri Kabalevsky, Aram Khachaturian, among others. Things were going very well in the musical life of Russia until the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, when the czars were toppled from power and the communists took over the government. The communists were not interested in progressive music. They wanted music that glorified the Russian people and the cause of the communist government. They wanted music that was easy to listen to. Some composers and musicians left the country quite rapidly. They did not want their creative freedom stifled. Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky, and Prokofiev left. Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky eventually came to the United States. Prokofiev did too. But he did not like the United States and went back to Russia. He would later regret his decision. Any adventurous music, as Prokofiev enjoyed composing, was banned. Not only music, but all the arts were restricted. Composers could not compose it. Audiences were not able to listen to it. And as Stalin tightened his controls, he essentially closed the whole country. No foreign publications, magazines, newspapers, radio broadcasts, or music was allowed in the country. The composers were organized into a union. Even the union was directed by Stalin's administration. In 1936, Stalin happened to go to a performance of Lady Macbeth of Zemsk. After the first act of this opera, Stalin walked out a raging storm. He called the music degenerate and issued three rules by which all music was to be composed by Russian composers. Number one, it had to be based on Russian folk song without any weird or harsh tonalities like he heard that night. Number two, any plot must have a happy ending. And number three, all subjects must have a socialist plot. In other words, a plot that somehow related to furthering the cause of the communists. When Shostakovich heard that Stalin had left his opera in a rage, Shostakovich feared for his life. Everyone who was friends with him all of a sudden decided they didn't want to be associated with him at all. They were afraid to be. Shostakovich himself thought of committing suicide rather than be dealt with by Stalin. He quickly wrote another symphony that fulfilled all three requirements. It was very blah, but it fulfilled all the requirements. He was returned to grace. It was during this period that Prokofiev wrote the famous children's classic, Peter and the Wolf, that has become a worldwide favorite. Things seemed to be under control for a few years until 1948, when the roof fell in. One of the composers wrote an opera with a little too much dissonance. It also did not glorify the Russian state. 3 months later, the Central Committee of the Communist Party held a meeting in which charges were brought against most of the major composers, including Kabalevsky, Prokofiev, Kachaturian, and poor Shostakovich. For 9 days, there was a meeting in Moscow for Soviet composers. For 9 days, they heard the tirades of an irate Stalin regime. At its conclusion, the politically wise Dmitry Kabalevsky led the way to safety by getting up and publicly acknowledging his musical sins, thanking Stalin for showing him the true light, and promising to reform in the future. Taking Kabalevsky's lead and hoping it would preserve their own lives, each composer took his turn, standing and acknowledging his musical sins. At the end of the meeting, all the composers wrote a joint letter to Stalin to express appreciation for pointing out their wicked ways. Here is an extract from the letter.
We are tremendously grateful to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and personally to you, dear Comrade Stalin, for the severe but profoundly just criticism of the present state of Soviet music. We shall make every effort to produce music reflecting the life and struggles of the Soviet people.
Talk about your brown nosing. But it worked. It appeased Stalin and saved their lives. At this point, all creative expression was squashed out. Shostakovich, writing of this in his memoirs, says,
I cannot go on describing my unhappy life, and I'm sure that no one can doubt now that it was unhappy. There were no particularly happy moments in my life, no great joys. It was gray and dull, and it makes me sad to think about it.
Life these people had to look forward to. At the beginning of the century, Russia was a bustling, aristocratic center with some of the greatest names in 20th century music. Toward the close of the century, There is not one living composer that is known internationally for his work. One would think that with the reforms of their leader Gorbachev and the opening of Soviet society, the composers of serious music would thrive and blossom. Actually, the reverse has occurred. Before Glasnost, concerts of avant-garde classical music were well attended. It was a quiet way the people could protest the government. However, since composers were freed in the 80s to write the way they wished, attendance and support for serious composition has declined drastically. One Russian composer, Serge Pavlenko, said in 1990, "We're seeing a decline in interest in the serious culture in general in our country. Just look at the huge explosion in the rock industry here. I'm afraid the prospects don't look very good for serious music." End quote. It may take time, but with the changes in Russian society that has occurred in the 90s, no doubt Russia again will produce artists and musicians that will wow the world with their musical gifts. As we end this side of the tape, let me ask the question I posed at the beginning. What does Joseph Stalin have to do with the music of Russia? How would you answer that now? As you think of your answer, we will conclude this tape the same way we began it, with a piece by Rachmaninoff, a Russian composer who came to America. It is called Polichinelle.